Turn to the book of John, 18th chapter of John. This is a very familiar passage, I think. Probably corporal in this room, it's been read thousands of times. It's something we read every Easter. We probably read it in our daily reading. We could probably recite it pretty much by memory, even without having tried to memorize it. It's so familiar to us. So we're going to read through it again. John chapter 18, verse 12 through 27. Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Then led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest. And he went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood at the door outside. Then the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. Then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You're not also one of the man's disciples, are you?" And he said, "I am not." Now the servants and officers who had made a fire cold stood there, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves. And Peter stood with them and warmed himself. The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered and said, "I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in temple where the Jews always meet. In secret, I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said." And when he said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of evil. But well, why do you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. Therefore he said to him, "You're not also one of the disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the disciples, the high priest, a relative of him whose Peter cut off, said, "Didn't I see you in the garden with him?" And Peter denied him again. Immediately a rooster crowed. There's several characters in this passage, and some of them we have the right idea about, and some of them we might not have the right idea about. And there's more going on than just Peter having his hopes dashed. I want you to understand that. Now, a cohort, I've been taught, that went to arrest Jesus actually has 600 men in it. Probably wasn't that many. When they got him, why did he think they took him to Annas? Let's back up a little bit. Annas and Caiaphas, what was the situation with the high priest in Jerusalem this time? Does anybody have any comment they want to add on that right now? Well, do you know the history of the high priesthood? Were they descended from the Judeans? The Hasmoneans? Anybody know? How many Jewish wars were there? Does anybody know that? Because this is important to understanding. Was a 1, 2, 3 Jewish and Roman wars. There's only three choices. Gene, guess.
Two.
Three. There were three. Right. There were three. Everybody knows about when the temple was destroyed in AD 70. It's also the Bar Kokhba event afterwards. And of course, the Hasmoneans were the priest rulers after the Maccabean revolt, before the Romans came and instituted their Pax Romana. I probably did not pronounce that right. That's Latin for, yeah, okay, John, I see 90. Roman peace, and their Roman peace was not very peaceful. They basically killed everybody they could catch. If you revolted, they might be nice and line up everybody and kill every 10th person, where we get the word decimate. But if you really annoyed them, they would kill everybody, all the men. You know, they ran out of men, they started working on women and children. That's how the Romans kept peace. And this is something that was not ancient history to the high priest. Let's go up to John 11, 47, 53. Who had that? Will you read that for me, please, Tim?
"So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.' But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish.' He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death.
Now we hear that in our perspective as automatically assume that Caiaphas worried about his own personal position, his own personal will. That's why I thought all my life, that's why I was taught most of my life. Does anybody here have a divergent opinion or something different? No. Well, I've recently changed my view on that. I think at least part of the Sanhedrin and Caiaphas' influence was they were concerned for their nation. They were worried that the Romans would come because they were existing as a Jewish nation with a high priesthood and usurpers, a king. The Herods or Idumeans. They were converts to Judaism. They were not native Jews. Were installed over them. And it was a false arrangement that the Romans permitted as long as the peace was maintained. As we've talked about other times, there were other messiahs who were coming along and proclaiming themselves to be the new ruler or new leader of Israel. The Bar Kaaba event, which was some years after destruction in Jerusalem, was a man who literally said he was Messiah and resulted in, that is what actually resulted in the mass killings in Judea and the Jews being expelled from Israel for 1800 years. This is something they had to consider. Not just their own hides, but what about their nation? And here was to them just another Messiah, just another guy out of the Galilean hills claiming that he is going to be the next ruler in Israel. And they see disaster. They see the Romans coming, taking away their place, slaughtering their people, destroying their temple. The actual house that most of these guys belonged to, as opposed to the theological school thought, was Beit Shammai. And I bet Jonathan can tell me the proper pronunciation for the guy headed Beit Shammai, I believe is the phonetic pronunciation. There are two main schools. There's Haliel, who Apostle Paul followed, and Shammai, who I probably am butchering the name. And they were two sides of the same coin. Shammai tended to be more conservative. If you said the blessing at the meal, great. If you forgot, went somewhere and remembered it, you had to return to where you ate your meal to say the blessing. That's the proper way to do it. Haliel was more liberal. You could say the blessing as soon as you remembered it anywhere he was. Shammai was the one that tore the roof off of the room that his daughter was giving birth in because that was a festival day when they were supposed to live in booths and not be in a house, and didn't want his new grandson to be disobeying the law. He also was going to starve one of his sons one day because it was a fasting day. Haliel, on the other hand, was very liberal in that you could learn, I'm not making this up, you could learn the entire Talmud while standing on one foot. That was actually a burning question they had. So we kind of giggle a little bit at these, but there are differences in the way they looked at different things. We look at 2,000 years later at the miracles that Christ did. I don't know about you, but I go, are you crazy? Who raises people from the dead if they aren't God? You know, that's a no-brainer to us. You know, he healed blind people, lame people, get up and walk. You saw him and you talked to him, and you still think he's just another guy out of the Galilean hills wanting to start a revolt. How could you make that mistake? Well, apparently did. I don't think there's any evidence, even though they acknowledged the miracles he did, they understood that this was who Jesus really was. They didn't understand that. On the other hand, the disciples themselves had a little trouble with this. Who has Matthew 16:13-19?
When Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And they said, some say thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets. He saith unto them, but whom say ye that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said unto him, blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven.
Boy, good old Peter. First one to speak up. That's Peter's confession right there. Thou art the Christ. Now, laws have a kind of a little bit of a smug opinion about Peter, if we're honest about it. Because Peter's always getting himself in trouble. You know, he's the first one to say something without thinking about it. He's the first one to jump into action without considering the consequences. He's the first one to make claims that he can't back up. And I thought the same thing, too, till just a few weeks ago. Barry did a thing over in the one room on Wednesday nights. And he talked about Peter and Christ and the storm, and he also talked about Christ walk across the water and Peter wanting to get out of the boat. And you know, I would say, Peter didn't have faith, blew the same. And Barry made a very profound statement. So where are the rest of the disciples? They're still in the boat. You know, I got thinking about it. I thought that about a lot last few weeks. The disciples didn't even bother trying to get out. Peter tried. You know, he got scared and he fell, but Peter tried. Disciples, they stayed in the boat. You know, when Christ is asking, who do you think I am? There was no 12 hands going up to ask me, I know. No, there's Peter who says, thou art the Christ. When he was getting his feet washed, you know, Peter said, no, you're not going to wash my feet, so I don't want, you know, you'll have no part of me. So, in that case, wash all of me. Peter, he's wanting to try. He is willing to go the effort. When they're in the garden, and here are these soldiers. It might not have been 600, but there were a bunch of soldiers there, and there were a bunch of officials from the temple. And, you know, everybody's looking around. Who does anything? Peter pulls out the sword. What? Now, actually, this is a technical point. But he probably was swinging this way, and the guy ducked his head, sliced his ear off. Don't ask me why I think that's important, but I always think that's kind of interesting. I always wonder when I was a kid, how did he chop an ear off and that's it? Well, that's probably why. He was arrested and taken to see Annas. Yeah, how many disciples are mentioned?
Peter and John.
Yeah, two. I think John will mention it. There are two that went. And one was scared. I mean, he was afraid. Where were the rest of the disciples? They're back home hiding. They aren't going. They aren't there. They didn't go to the garden. And when they hear about the shenanigans going on, they don't bother rushing to see what's going on. They weren't even invited. My opinion is Peter has risen commissary as a result of this. The more I study Peter, the more admirable. And that's the shape of the lesson I think we can draw from this. It's not a case of Peter failing. It's a case of Peter trying. Even though Christ knew he would fail. Christ told him right at the start. Yes, Gene.
Chip, I was thinking about what you said a while ago, that Peter often commented and rushed into things and didn't have to think about it. And we look at that as being a negative. But I was thinking, you know, there are some things that ought to be so resolute in our hearts and we're so convinced of, that we ought to be able to answer things without much thought. As far as our salvation, as far as the deity of Christ, and a number of other articles of our faith, we ought not to have when we're questioned. We ought not have to stop and think, well, now let me see what this person would like for me to say, or am I really convinced of it? So you have to at least give Peter a certain degree of admiration that he could answer a lot of things without thinking. Now, I realize that has positives and negatives to it, but I think it can be a positive.
In my opinion to Peter, his heart wasn't just in the right place, but his mind was in the right place. He knew, had probably a better understanding of who Jesus was than many of the other disciples. And here they are in a courtyard. It's cold. He's miserable. He's scared. He's surrounded by enemies. The man that he's been following for the last 3 years is being questioned, being put on trial. By the way, the reason they take him to Annas and are seeking him to say something, they have to come up with the reason that for the Romans to let them crucify him. Because the Jews could not put anybody to death under the Pax Romana. They could not do that. The Romans had to put them to death. And the Romans would not execute anybody for religious reason. They didn't do that anywhere. Now, it was some minor squabbling. We're not, but they would for treason. Because especially in Israel, which was a notoriously rebellious part of the realm, these messiahs kept appearing. And they might not last long, but they caused huge problems. And if they could get him to confess to them that he was the king of Israel, he was the Messiah, if they could get him to say that, then they could use his words to convince the Romans to kill him. And this is illegal under Jewish law, by the way. You cannot, same as the United States, cannot compel someone to give testimony against themselves. What the man's actually doing is illegal. They're meeting at night. That's also illegal. There's a whole bunch of things contrary to Jewish civil law that were being broken this night. Now, I always wondered, what motivates a man to be so callous-hearted and so foolish and so blind that they would turn on the eternal Son of God to have him in the flesh? There had to be something about Jesus that was different than, say, me or Mr. McKay. I can't help but believe that the Son of God was, because he was, in some integral way different. But it didn't seem to affect them at all. It didn't have any import of his importance. They saw him as a problem. The Sadducees were mostly the ruling class. The Pharisees were the ones that originally were the ones that kept the law and made the law apparent to the people. They're usually called teacher. They tended to see all the creation differently than we do. The Sadducees didn't believe there's any eternal life. To them, this is all there is. Their duty is to obey God, to fulfill the law, to follow the law to the best of their ability, and thereby honor God, to keep their people pure and holy, and then they died. All the rewards they had were on this world. Now, you stop and think about that. That gives you a little different perspective on everything, because we don't believe that at all. We know this world is not our home. We even have a song we sing about, "This world is not my home, I'm only passing through." We have an entirely different outlook on the world. But to the Sadducees, the world is all there was. They were a part of it. They were a special part of it. They were a unique part of it. They were set aside. God blessed their part. But this is all they had. This was it. It was more important to maintain what they had because there was nothing else for them to look forward to or try to maintain or support or invest in. So when the Son of God, the Emmanuel, was slapped by that soldier, he didn't think about it the same way we were. Here, this is the most important man in the country, and you're being smart to him. You're being rude to him. That was the attitude they had. Meanwhile, out by the fire, Peter is sitting there shivering, thinking, what am I going to do if they find out who I am? What's going to happen to me? What do you think might have happened to him if he had said, "Yes, I am one of his disciples"? What was he afraid of? What do you think?
Probably going to arrest him, I guess.
Might arrest him. What else might happen to him? You ever thought about it? I never thought about much either till the last couple of weeks. One thing, he would have been barred entrance into the space where Caiaphas' courtyard was. He wouldn't have known what was going on. Peter desperately wanted to be where his Lord was. desperately wanted to be there. He would have probably have been arrested also. He would have been flogged. Scourge, they called it. He might have been stoned. Certainly, he would be in big trouble. But still, he went. Yes?
I'm just wondering, do you think part of why he might have denied, I've never thought about it this way before, but do you think he was worried if he did admit to it that he might have to give testimony against Jesus? And maybe it was more of a... actually more of a good reason for why he denied?
That's a good point. I had not considered that before. But it is some. I mean, just because he's a fisherman doesn't mean he's dumb. Peter was fairly sharp also. Perhaps that is something we should consider if they had known. However, the tenor of the conversation seems to come across that he was afraid, and it could be both. One translation, he actually cursed at the maiden and said, "No, I do not know the man." It's difficult. No, we really can't go back 2,000 years and state with certainty everything that was going on. But I think it's worth considering. I never heard that before. Here we are. Jesus is being interrogated. And the high priest asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. And Jesus points out, "I spoke openly to the world, always taught in the synagogues and the temple where Jews would meet. In secret, I've said nothing." Who is usually in the crowd listening besides the common people? Come on, this is a gimme. The Pharisees were there. Again, name another group that was commonly there disputing with Jesus.
The Sadducees.
Okay. The Herodians were sometimes mentioned. They're more political set. They weren't necessarily a theological set. So they had been listening. They were very in tune with what he'd been preaching on. This was not a strange thing to Annas at all. He knew exactly what Christ meant. He was probably had watched as some of his minions had been debating with Jesus. Many of the discourses in the Gospels between Christ and the Sadducees, the Pharisees, were probably witnessed by the very man who was questioning him here. Talk about chutzpah. That's a Hebrew word I bet you don't know, Jonathan. Right. "Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said." Take that out of that part of the gospel written 2,000 years ago and apply that to ourselves. That is the same instruction that we are given. We are to tell people what Christ said. We are to tell people what Christ did. We are to witness through our lives what Christ is. That right there is to me the key verse. "Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said." And when he sees things, one of the officers stood, struck, says, "Do you answer high priest like that?" He said, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" At this point, this is a salient point of the law that oftentimes is overlooked. Being falsely accused, a false witness, and being injured falsely. These guys, especially the ones of the Beth Shemai school, were all about following every jot and tittle of the law. That's why they didn't want Jesus healing on the Sabbath. That's why they didn't want the disciples picking a little piece of a top of an oat and rolling it in the hand so they have something to eat. That's why they didn't want you kindling a fire on the Sabbath, because the keeping the law was the most important thing. Keeping the law was what their religion was about. Keeping the law was what pleased God. And keeping the law was all there was. And it's not pointed out, but Christ is pointing out to them they're breaking their own law right now. Immediately, Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, not too long ago, we dug up, but I didn't. I've never even been to Israel, but somebody was digging up old tombs while they were building a new highway in Israel. and they come across an ossuary. An ossuary, when they buried Jews, is a box about like this and this and this. And they would take you and put you in the tomb and wrap you up, and it was a loose-fitting linen garment, and they put the stuff in there, so it's kind of crude, but so the body decomposed, the odor would be masked a little bit. And a year later, they open the tomb, go back in, take the shell, gather up the bones, and put them in an ossuary, a box that would have the inscription on it, the name or something. And they put that on a shelf up in the tomb, and that left other shelves ready for the next customer. They found this ossuary that they could read the inscription on, and it was the Caiaphas family. And they think, we found this guy's dead bones. Because a lot of the events that are recorded in the Gospels are not recorded in other historical references very often. Josephus mentions Jesus. There's some vague mention in Roman records about a Jewish agitator named Yeshua that was executed. And Caiaphas and Herod and Pilate, even Quirinius, who was reigning as a Plutarch, is that what they called him when Christ was born? There's very little reference to him. So now we have an actual box full of bones of the person whose father-in-law was tried Jesus. Does that not make you chill just a little bit there? That's pretty neat. I guess you expect him to be dead after 2,000 years. You don't expect to see him walking around, but it's a tangible evidence. We live by faith, and where we found some dead guy's bones or not, it's not going to change how we feel about it. But it's really neat to say, yes, you know, that's right. We know that. There's been a little bit of fuss. If you read biblical archaeology, this is a big hot event in their magazine right now. And another archaeologist says, no, that's not it. Then they found out, they found his son's remains also. Not Annas, they found Caiaphas and his son. It's a real interesting subject, but we're a little bit off. Now Simon Peter stood and warned himself, therefore he said to him, you're not also one of the disciples. He nodded and said, no. Let's read, we've read Peter's confession. Who has Matthew 14, 28 through 31?
And Peter answered, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. And he said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. And Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, O, you of little faith, why did you doubt?
All right, who are the next one? Is that Brittany? Read forward, please.
Simon Peter said unto him, Lord, whither goest thou? Jesus answered him, whither I go, thou canst not follow me now, but thou shalt follow me afterwards. Peter said unto him, Lord, why can I not follow thee now? I will lay down my life for thy sake. Jesus answered him, wilt thou lay down thy life for my sake? Verily, verily, I say unto thee, the cock shall not crow till thou hast denied me thrice.
Right, Rick.
Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. And she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and said to them, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb. We did not know where they had laid him. Peter therefore went out with the other disciples and were going to the tomb. So they both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb first. And he stooped down, looking in, and saw linen cloths lying there, yet did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, went into the tomb, and he saw the linen clothes lying there, and the handkerchief that had been around his head.
Stop right there, Rick. Thank you. Peter ultimately did what he told Christ he would do. He had some slips, he had some slides, he had some problems, he denied him. But he wanted his Lord. He followed his Lord. He went to that tomb. Where were the other disciples? Hiding. When they went back and told, when women told them, it was idle tales. Oh, you're just making it up. Who went? Who left that room knowing they were being searched for, knowing what might very well happen? Who went to that tomb? John and Peter. Boy, we make fun of Peter a lot, but I wish I could be as strong-willed in my desire as Peter was towards his Lord. How many times do we get the idea that when we sin, oh, we're in trouble now, we better hurry up and confess this, we are out of fellowship with God because we sin until we ask and receive forgiveness, okay? It's kind of natural. It's the way our life experience teaches us as things happen. You know, your wife likes you until you do something stupid. Then she's mad at you until you do something to make her like you again. Your father is angry with you because you disobeyed. Until you fix it, then he does something, okay, everything's golden again. You are behind on your bills until you get enough money to pay them. And then you're caught up again. That's the way, but that's not the way it works between God and us. How many sins had Jonathan over there, yes, you, Jonathan, how many had he committed when Christ died for your sins?
None of them.
Or all of them. That's the way you look. It already happened to Christ's perspective, you know. All those sins you've done, he didn't die just for the ones you asked forgiveness, for all of them. He knew that Peter was going to deny him three times before Christ was born on this earth. He knew that. He knew what was going to happen. He knew the lie that I was going to tell my mama why I got caught doing whatever it was I got caught doing. He knew the things that Mr. Leiter would behold in his heart when some teacher gives him a bunch of lip. All right. He knew what Mr. McKay would say under his breath when the cow tail slaps him in the face in the middle of the night while he's milking. He knows the temptations that we have and the times we're going to yield. From eternity. He already knew that. And he knew what Peter's heart would be. Yes?
The problem we have with Peter's thinking, I believe, is the fact that as a grown-up, we would say he was impetuous. But his faith was a childlike faith.
Yeah.
And that's not impetuousness.
I would agree with that. He didn't know what to do with it, I think.
Right there on the edge.
Yeah, it's right there, but he's like somebody with a brand new motorcycle. You know, they lay it on the side every now and then. They run it through a wall, perhaps hit the curb or cross road tracks at an angle, and they have problems with it. Okay, it's a very poor analogy about Christianity and Harley Davidson. But you get what I mean. It was something entirely new to all of them. We don't appreciate that because we have 2,000 years perspective. We know better than they do. But we don't just have to cut Peter a little bit slack. We have to admire the man. John comes off really good in this because he's always the disciple Jesus loved. He is always the other disciple. He didn't even name himself. But John never has any problems with his faith according to this gospel. Yes?
I guess it really has just stood out to me the example Peter gives us then to be just so eager to do something, to do whatever we can for the Lord, that we're just ready to do it all the time. And if he were holding back, trying to be so mature to get everything right, he probably wouldn't have been the leader that he became, or he would have missed out on so many opportunities. But, you know, he was so trying, like you're saying, just to serve the Lord in something that eventually the Lord used him. He was a leader of the church and got to participate with the Lord in so many things, be used in so many ways. I guess it's just been a real challenge and example to me this morning, just to just be eager, just ready to try, just ready to serve the Lord in whatever we possibly can.
So you might have another perspective on Peter. Now it's time to ask a question, make a comment. Yes?
What I really appreciate, it's been encouragement to me, is that Peter didn't let even his denial of Christ keep him from serving Christ. And whether I've done it with my lips, I haven't done it with my lips as far as I can remember, but I've done it with my life, where I've denied Christ in my actions and my behavior, and whether I was willing to speak up for him or not in certain situations. And sometimes you, afterward, you feel so bad about it that you say, man, why would God ever want to use me? And Peter will come to mind many times how Peter then in Acts chapter 2 preached that fabulous message and people were saved and became a leader in the church, as he's mentioned. He didn't let a failure keep him from going forward and serving. And I've met a lot of people because of something in their past or something that happened last week, have this idea, God can't use me because I'm no good and I'm innocent. And Peter should be an encouragement to people that God can use any of us that will just be surrendered and committed. And of course, Peter wept. He was broken. And the broken and contrite spirit he'll not despise. And so Peter is a real encouragement to me because of me and the type of person I am. I'm not perfect either and fail. And to think that God greatly used Peter, maybe he could use me.
Well, you ever feel God's mad at me? God's too mad. I'm not going to pray. I'm going to wait things cool down a little bit before I even talk to God anymore, you know. Yes?
We need to remember that Jesus said, unless you come like one of these little children with that kind of an attitude. You know, and I think that's very important.
Bounce. Good. Come on, Gene. God can say something else profound tonight. Yes? Pastor George.
I've always thought of it as Peter reacting instead of acting, but under the control of the Spirit of God, he learned to act.
Anybody else? What do you think Caiaphas' state of mind? And there's no way to answer this. But Caiaphas and Annas might not have been aware of who Christ was while they were trying him and executing him. But at the resurrection, when the earthquake came and the veil was torn from top to bottom and the tombs were open, talk about chagrin. I would hope then they had an understanding of what had happened and the part they had played in it at that time. Certainly one Roman soldier did. But yet there are many who apparently in the city that were very aware of these events, who still did not believe that Jesus was the Son of God. Yes?
I just have a question. In the Gospel of John, it talks about Caiaphas was the high priest that year, mm-hmm. or something like that. Later in Acts 4, it talks about, it says Annas, the high priest. So I didn't know. It seems like
they're always addressed title high priest. President Nixon was addressed as President Nixon while he was in hide in New York City. President Reagan, we always referred to him President Reagan for years afterwards. That title, Annas was actually Caiaphas' father-in-law, not his father. You appreciate that. He married a daughter. Had several other sons. The Hasmoneans were the people who were the priests after Maccabean revolt till the Romans came. There was Aristobulus, I believe his name is, was the last high priest. Well, Herod made him the high priest, so Herod himself could reign as king as the Roman puppet. He was actually the last of the legal priest kings. The Caiaphas line, and they would alter, they would descend depending on really as much family politics as temple procedure, who was going to be the high priest. Some of them served for a year, some I believe for as long as 3 years. And that's really the best answer I can give you because it is a very complicated procedure. The lineage of the priest, the Herod family, the Roman edicts in the different wars that have. It's fascinating, but it leaves your mind a whirl, let me tell you. Anybody else? Yes, Gene.
You know, all of the priests had to attain a certain age. I think they had there were certain duties they could do in the Aaronic priesthood, but they couldn't assume the full role of priest, I think, till they were like 30. And then they could serve till, I think, age 50. And then they were done with their priesthood duties. And Annas had served his term as a high priest, as the chief priest. And he was entitled, as you said, to be called the chief priest, but he was not in office at this time. He was related to Caiaphas by marriage, but Caiaphas was the ruling or reigning high priest at the time these events took place. So Annas was looked at much like we look at former presidents. He was admired, he was respected, people went to him for advice and for his knowledge of having held the office, and he's entitled to the title of high priest, but not the officiating high priest at the time.
Yes, Mr. Lytle.
In a time when, at this time, when most everybody didn't know where the next meal was coming from, very, very poor, the old saying, you can usually follow the money. Well, Caiaphas and Annas were very wealthy, and they had a lot of money coming from all different sources, like the selling of the animals in the temple, a lot of things that they were very, very wealthy.
That's a good point. They profited directly off of that. Yes, continue, Mr. Lytle.
Well, I think that's one reason why they were just blinded by their money and their wealth, and they didn't want to change. They didn't want anybody coming in and upsetting their lifestyle, as we would say today. They're very, very wealthy people.
Good. Anybody else? Yes, Mr. McKay.
It still puzzles me to this day how people can, in their own thinking, seem to feel like life goes on forever for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that these high priests and so forth, they didn't seem to think beyond the end of their nose. Mm-hmm. They didn't realize and give any consideration to the fact that life goes on and this was winding down.
No, there wasn't a consideration to them at all, I don't think. Not at all. Anybody else? Yes.
I have a question. Yes. Yes. I just want to get your opinion.
Oh, I'm full of opinions.
Okay, good. What do you think changed? Because as I look at this passage, I see just a few verses ahead, Simon Peter cuts off the ear of the Malchus, I think was his name. He was willing to, at that point, it looks like, die for, you know, Christ, because he committed a very bold action. And then you read, you know, however many verses later, he's denying Christ. What do you think changed in his attitude in that span of time to make him go from that point to the extreme opposite?
I thought about this too. There is two kinds of action that are being contemplated. One is reaction, fearful reaction, tension, anger. Same as if you come around a corner and your husband jumps out of the closet and goes boo. Now, what do? Whop! Or you scream, ah! Or you jump back or you push, you know. If you have something in your hand, you might poke him with it. Or if you like my wife, you might stab. I got stabbed with a knitting needle one time doing that. Not hard. They were pretty blunt and they's not too strong. But the act of going there is a deliberative action where he has time to think about it and start to worry about it and reconsider his choice. And I don't think he reconsidered his choice, but I think there's a little more to be given to your point that he was hiding, more of a, instead of a fearful person for his life, partly also being smart enough about, now I'm not getting in the door if I admit I'm a disciple, that might very well be, But clearly, cursing at a little maid and denying that he is the one showed his fear also. I think that is the difference between the two. He had a sword, you know, hoping he wasn't going to use it because they're in the garden by themselves. I don't know. Maybe he carried a sword all the time. Maybe the word being used as sword could be transliterated into large fishing knife. He was a fisherman. I don't know. There's so much of the scripture that we're not told because apparently God does not think it's important. We're told the important things. But that would be my answer. One time he's surprised, he's mad, he's angry. Well, let's do something about it. Whack. And then they're leading him off. What am I going to do? What are you going to do? I don't know. Yes.
I've had a lot of thoughts whirling in my head about that very thing this morning, and I wonder if maybe Peter got confused a little bit in between because there was this transition in the Old Testament, the way the Lord was dealing, the heroes like Ehud and Gideon, they were the guys who fought, and they fought against God's enemies and glorified the Lord in that way. So Peter thinks, oh, the Lord's being captured, the way to fight for the Lord and serve him is, let's fight, you know, wipe out these guys, just like Samson would take a bone and, you know, kill 1,000 people. And he starts to fight, and then the Lord stops him, and he puts the guy's ear back on and goes away meekly with them. And I wonder if poor Peter's all confused, like, well, I was trying. I thought this is what we were supposed to do, and I don't know what to do. And
that's just pretty good. The Zealots were known for hiding short sword under their garment, coming up behind a Roman soldier, sticking him, and then running off. That was part of the warfare they fought. Certainly one of the disciples was one of the Zealots. Anybody familiar with what a Zealot is? We would call them a guerrilla today. That might be a very valid point. Yes,
Dr. Herbst. Mine's maybe a pretty simplistic thought, but it resonates with me because Peter was bold because he was with Jesus, and Jesus gives you boldness and power. And then Jesus is taken away, and he's by himself in a secular environment, and he's not willing to stand at that point. And that I see myself again sometimes, you know, and I think others, when we're with the Lord and with his crowd, well, we can stand with the best of them.
I like that too, but I think that's all of a sudden, good point too.
We're out there in our secular job, and we're out there with people that think we're loonies, then we're a little more passive. We're just not willing to take quite the stand, and it's why it's so important to just walk with Jesus all the time and have that Spirit living with us all the time. But that's my answer to that question, because and I think the confusion was there too, obviously. This was the guy I thought was going to handle it all.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's gone. Now what do I do?
Yeah. So, but why the high priest steward's ear? Now, why not the centurion's ear? Why not the arresting officer's ear? Was the steward actually the arresting officer that was doing it? Or was he just the nearest guy or the smallest guy that Peter thought he could take down? All right, we won't discuss that because we're about out of time. Does anybody else have a comment or a question? Yes.
It's puzzling as well that all of those soldiers there didn't jump on Peter right quick. They weren't very defensive of the rest of their crowds.
Well, in another account, it actually says they fell down or they fell back. That's a little outside purview this morning. If we were covering the entire event, we would be reading from all four Gospels. I'm a very big proponent, if you want to know what the Bible says, you want to know what God wants, you look up every bit of Scripture that concerns that. Do not make the mistake of saying, well, there's this much Scripture that supports this, this much supports this. And whichever more, no, Bible only says one thing about something. You may get a bunch of different pieces from different sources, but it only says one thing. The crucifixion account, the arrest accounts, you need to look at all the record to get a full picture. Mainly what we're considering right now is John's account of Peter's reaction and Christ's witness and the callous indifference of those that condemned and arrested him. And I think it's very illuminating. I like Peter. I admire Peter a lot more than I did a few weeks ago.